Well, the bumper music that you hear, the Christmas bumper music that you'll only get once a year here on Coast to Coast, the music at the half-hour mark is by my friend Jim Manley here of St. Louis. He's just a phenomenal trumpet player. Just came back from Europe where he was invited out there to play as well. So the half bumper music that you hear on the half-hour, that's Jim Manley of St. Louis. A mission that will scour space for Earth-like planets is scheduled for launch on Wednesday. Korat will be the first spacecraft capable of detecting planets outside of the solar system that are just a few times larger than Earth. The French-led multinational mission will also help uncover the secrets of stellar interiors. That'll be an incredible, incredible mission. In a moment, creation is science, creator in the cosmos. Our guest, Hugh Ross, on Coast to Coast AM. Hugh Ross launched his career at age 7 when he went to the library to find out why stars are hot. In physics and astronomy, captured his curiosity. He never let it go. At age 17, he was the youngest person ever to serve as director of observations for Vancouver's Royal Astronomical Society. And with the help of a provincial scholarship and a National Research Council fellowship, he completed his undergraduate degree in physics and graduate degrees in astronomy. The NRC also sent him to the United States for his postdoctoral studies at Caltech. He taught courses and researched quasi-stellar objects, or quasars, some of the most distant and ancient objects in the universe. And right now, he directs the efforts of Reasons to Believe, an institute founded to bring to the forefront the relationship between scientific discoveries and the Bible. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hugh, welcome. Welcome back. It's been a while. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good, good. Always appropriate to have you on a day like today, Hugh. But it's good to talk with you. What have you been doing since we last chatted about a year and a half ago?
Well, we've been working on several books that are fleshing out our testable creation model. We're trying to do is build a comprehensive and a detailed scientific explanation for the history of the universe and the history of life, and then develop scientific predictions based on our model of what scientists will discover in the future.
Now, is it tied into religion at all, or events that we read in the Bible, or is it all just strictly pure science?
Well, we argue in a number of our books that theology and science completely overlap. That there's no scientific explanation that doesn't have theological implications. For that matter, there's no theological precept that doesn't have significant scientific implications. And therefore, we welcome the overlap, but we say we have to put it to the test.
Yeah, I agree with that, Hugh, entirely. I just wish more scientists or more theologians would match up together and realize that if they do work hand in hand, we might get the answers a little quicker than we're getting right now.
Amen.
Appropriate word as well. Hey, lots have been going on in space and science. You, like I, got interested in much of this field when events occurred when we were young. We were curious. It pushed us. It steered us in the direction we're headed now. Is there anything out there that continues to perplex you as you investigate, as you write, as you continue to put together more research projects and more books?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the big problem we've been working on the past, say, 6 months is the nature of the cosmic darkness, why the universe is so dark. It's 99.73% made up of dark stuff. Exactly where is that dark stuff? Why is it in that location? And why is it so extraordinarily fine-tuned to make life possible, and human life in particular?
It might be more important than the matter we see.
Definitely.
And with that, one has to continually knock your head against the wall to try to figure out just what is it. We don't really know. Do we have any grasp at all what it could be?
Yes, we do. I mean, we know that there's about 6 times as much exotic matter as there is ordinary matter, and about 3 times as much what we call dark energy as there is all matter combined. But what we haven't yet discovered are which particles, fundamental particles, actually make up this exotic dark matter.
In one of your books, Creator in the Cosmos, you talk a lot about that relationship between space and the Creator. Are you personally convinced that there's some kind of divine intervention here?
Yes, I am, if for no other reason that the theory of general relativity has now been shown to be the most reliable principle in all of physics. And based on general relativity, we have what are called the space-time theorems of general relativity, which tell us that not only does matter and energy have a beginning, but even space and time itself, and therefore the causal agent for the universe is some kind of entity beyond space and time and matter and energy that brings this universe of matter, energy, space, and time into existence. When you combine that with the extraordinary fine-tuning design we see in the different cosmic characteristics that make human life in particular possible, it not only points to a divine being, I think it actually helps you to identify who exactly that divine being is.
You know, Hugh, when we talk about the dark matter, I am so convinced that everything in this universe, at least the universe that we're part of, has a purpose. They're all pieces of a little puzzle. There's a reason why, almost like gears in a watch. If you take one little gear out of a watch that you might not have any idea what it does, the whole thing falls apart. It doesn't work. I think that's the same thing with the universe. Am I close in my thoughts?
I think you are, and I think you can even go beyond that. I mean, a number of astronomers have recognized, as I have, that the universe has the purpose of providing a habitat for human life. But what we're also discovering is that the universe evidently has been purposed to allow us to observe it and discover things about the universe and the causal agent behind the universe. It also seems to be extraordinarily designed to make possible a rapid and efficient conquest of evil and suffering. That and several other purposes tell us that this universe is far more amazing than anyone ever dreamed.
You know, every time somebody dies, and I do an obit on the program, like today, two more well-known people died, Frank Stanton, who used to head up CBS, he was the president, and, you know, the rapper James Brown. I always say to myself, okay, what was their purpose? I know what they did when they were on this planet. I know the impact of what they did, but why in the heck were they here? And I think about that a lot, even about myself, and I don't have any answers to that yet. I don't understand why we're here.
Well, the interesting thing is we're the one species that even bothers to ask that question, which tells us that the universe must somehow be purposed to allow us to fulfill a divine purpose that's far beyond the cosmos itself. One thing we now know is that our hope, purpose, and destiny can't reside in the universe in which we live because it's not going to maintain conditions for life that are going to last for eternity, far less than that.
I've got a little Labrador retriever here in St. Louis. I've got a couple dogs that are scattered all over the city, but this one I keep. And, you know, you're right, because this little critter, all she does is, you know, she gets up in the morning, she has fun, she plays, she eats, she sleeps. I don't think she worries about what's her purpose here in the universe. She just enjoys her day every day.
Right.
And she does it again the next day.
Yeah, we're really the only species that wants to know, why is the universe there? Does it have a beginning? Will it end? What is my purpose in the universe? What is my purpose beyond the universe? Is there life after death? You're right. The dogs and cats never bother with those kinds of philosophical issues.
I wonder if they're enjoying themselves more than we are because they don't ask that question.
Well, that's an interesting point in itself.
Lots have been going on in science, Hugh, over the last couple months. These recent discoveries of ice and different kinds of channels on Mars, and now they're beginning to wonder just how much water is on Mars. Did they indeed have huge lakes, oceans, rivers? What's your take on that, and how does that equate into some of the work you've been doing?
Well, there's been literally hundreds of papers published on this whole issue of water on Mars. And, you know, there's definitely water there. but it's not at all unexpected. I mean, Mars receives on a daily basis a fresh load of water from cometary impact. Comets, after all, are 80% frozen water. And therefore, it's no surprise that Mars has a little bit of water. And the quantity we're discovering on Mars fits about what we'd expect from cometary delivery. Now, if it falls in a place that's cold, like the poles, it'll stay, it'll remain. However, Mars has a very thin atmosphere, and it's such that the boiling point of water is identical to the freezing point.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if you get anywhere close to the equatorial zones on Mars, that frozen water will either go into liquid form and then into vapor form or straight into vapor form. But if it goes into liquid form, it'll remain liquid for only 1 or 2 seconds. So it's not like the liquid water that we see a little bit of evidence for on Mars has any applications with respect to life. You got to keep it for more than 1 or 2 seconds for it to bring life to any form that could possibly be there. And I've always been on record as saying that if we look hard enough, we will find the remains of life on Mars. But it's not because I believe life is indigenous to Mars. It's because Mars is so close to planet Earth that it receives a load of Earth life and Earth life remains on a fairly continual basis. And the question is that water on Mars going to do that Earth-transported life any good? And I don't think so, because of the conditions simply won't allow liquid water to exist for a very long period of time.
You think we seeded our planet Mars?
I think planet Earth has infected the entire solar system. Now, the moon, I think, is really the place to go to find the remains of Earth life. In fact, I'm rather excited about returning to the moon because the earliest fossils we have on planet Earth date back to only 3.5 billion years ago. And we have sound chemical evidence that life has been abundant on planet Earth as far back as 3.80 billion years ago. But because of the geology of Earth, those first life forms have been destroyed. On the other hand, the moon and to a much lesser degree Mars will have retained those fossils of Earth's life because the geology there is so tame that it's still in pristine form. Now, if you go to the moon, you're looking at about 20,000 pounds of Earth material for every 100 square kilometers, whereas for Mars, you're down to only about 200 pounds.
Ah, okay.
So the moon is really the best place to go to find the remains of Earth's first life. But if you look hard enough on Mars, you should find it there, too.
But that doesn't mean that if you find the remains of Earth's first life on the moon, that it even existed there for any amount of time, right?
Well, it existed there for, 3.8 billion years, but it got transported from the Earth. It's not something that the moon ever spawned on its own.
Right, right.
Likewise, the discovery of the remains of life on Mars will not prove that life originated on Mars, simply that it got transported from the Earth.
Nor did Mars keep it alive, right?
Exactly.
Whatever it might be.
On the other hand, I think it'd be wonderful if we could discover exactly what the fossils of Earth's first life looked like, because the chemical evidence only gives us a broad brush of the different species of bacteria that are at the base of the tree of life on planet Earth. The discovery of the actual fossils will give us a lot more detail.
If there is an intelligent creation behind all of this, Hugh, what is the rationale for this progression? You know, we talk about this life of 3.5 billion years ago, and I'm sure it was microbial, very minute. Was there an intelligent progression here where it said, all right, for this to become man, we need it to be in these stages, and it's going to take billions of years to get here. But that's the plan. That's how it's supposed to be, and that's how I design it. Do you think it was done that way?
I think so, and I think God made us to be very curious, and that curiosity is supposed to drive us to find exactly the reasons why. Now, I don't think we know all of them yet, but one thing we do see in the fossil record is evidently the past 3.8 billion years of life is focused on putting into the crust of the earth and the atmosphere all the resources that human beings would need to launch global high-technology civilization. I mean, if it wasn't for those 3 billion years of bacterial activity on the earth between 3.8 and, say, 3.3 billion years ago, we would have metals on the planet that would be poisonous to us. But thanks to those bacteria, they transformed all those soluble heavy metals into insoluble form, and at the same time concentrated those metals into very productive ore deposits. So today we can come along and mine these things that the bacteria have concentrated and use it to launch civilization. And of course, everyone's familiar with the petroleum, the coal, and the natural gas. None of that would be there for our available use unless it was for those millions of generations of life forms that preceded us.
Hugh, do you think that somewhere in our solar system we will find intelligent life, whether it was past or present, in the form of artifacts, cities, something?
I don't think so, because one thing we can recognize from looking at the physics of the universe, if you want one planet with intelligent life on it, you need the entire universe to make it happen. In fact, what's interesting is that the density, the parameters of the universe, are so extraordinarily fine-tuned, for example, that if you were to add a single dime to the observable mass of the universe or subtract that dime away, there'd be no place for us to live. Life would be impossible in the universe unless it was that extraordinary fine-tuned. So the fact that the universe is 14 billion years old and contains maybe 50 billion trillion stars, all that is necessary to provide one home. And from a biblical perspective, you can ask yourself the question, how many planets does God need, and how many of those planets would need to be inhabited by physical intelligent beings for him to be able to fulfill all the purposes he had in creating the universe? And from what I can see in the physics of the universe and what I can see of my study of the Bible, he only needs one. And then we have our study of extrasolar planets, and we're noticing is that the assumption we had 10 years ago that our solar system would prove to be common is not proving to be the case at all. Now that we've discovered more than 200 planets outside of our solar system, we know to a far greater degree just how extraordinarily designed our particular solar system is, so there's a planet like Earth that could have life inhabiting it. So it's made a huge challenge to the old Drake equation calculations that fostered the idea that life was everywhere in the universe.
So there may be millions, if not billions, of planets in the universe.
Right.
But those like ours are very rare.
Right, right. In fact, one of the things we do on our website at reasons.org is actually give you a formal calculation of what we discovered in the scientific literature on all the characteristics that must be fine-tuned to make bacterial life possible on a planet and to make human life possible on a planet. And those odds are far less than one chance in 10 to the 400, even if you take into account the entire observable universe.
So, though there may be other Earth-like planets out there, few and far between.
Right, right.
How are we going to find them, Hugh?
Well, I mean, we have a number of programs searching for planets right now. There's about four different techniques that we use to discover planets. And so far, none of them are showing up anything that would make possible an Earth-type planet.
And I just mentioned this new one that's going to be launched on Wednesday. Maybe that'll help. Stay with us. Hugh Ross, our guest next hour. We'll open up the phone lines for you and Hugh Ross. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM this Christmas night. With our special guest, Hugh Ross. I'll be back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Hugh Ross, our guest. Hugh, do you believe that this planet may have been visited by extraterrestrial beings?
I see no evidence of that ever happening. I mean, I know all the stories that have gone on there,
sure.
but I think a lot of it is a failure to recognize just how skilled our ancient civilizations were. I mean, and they were not afraid to invest huge amounts of resources, both money and manpower, towards projects that today we would never think of putting that kind of investment in.
So do you think our technology back 20, 30, 50,000 years ago was very high compared to what we've got today?
Well, thousands of years ago, the ancients were very interested in astronomy. And they were able to develop equipment with, you know, Stone Age-type technology that was able to position, say, the pyramids on certain star positions with an accuracy of about 1/15th of a moon diameter. Now, that's not something you would ordinarily do unless you're putting a huge amount of observing time and a huge amount of investment. I mean, the fact that some of the pyramids cost 25% of the gross national product of Egypt, for example, that would be unheard of today to put up a monument that was that expensive. But back in those days, they had no problem putting that kind of investment into it. And with that kind of investment and 100,000 slaves, you can make things with great precision.
What about the Bible, or at least the interpretation of the Bible, when it talks about fallen angels, which one could assume to be extraterrestrial, or Ezekiel's wheel, which one could assume to be some kind of spacecraft? What about those possibilities?
Well, when I said earlier I was skeptical about the idea that there was extraterrestrial life, I was referring to physical extraterrestrial life.
All right.
As a believer in the Bible and the Christian faith, I recognize that God has created two different kinds of intelligent beings. He's created human beings that are physical and confined to the space-time dimensions of this universe, but complementing that intelligent life is another species, the angelic species, and they're not confined to the space-time dimensions of the universe. So yeah, in that sense, for example, I believe that the residual UFO phenomena, although not physical in nature, is real. And that the causal agent is angelic.
Okay, so if it is angelic, and that's a very strong possibility, what proof that this exists in the universe, this angelic realm? Maybe that is where this dark matter might be. I mean, maybe the angelic realm is in that area.
I don't think so. I think this darkness is totally explained by the physics of the universe. We don't have to go into metaphysics to explain either dark energy or exotic dark matter. But if you were to ask me what hard scientific proof do we have of the angelic realm, well, a book we wrote a number of years ago, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, documents how the UFO phenomena can be 99% explained by natural phenomena, human activity, or hoaxes. But there's a 1% residual that defies that kind of explanation. And that 1% residual adds up to about 1 million documented cases. So it's not a trivial database. When you look into that database, you discover physical effects. For example, there's about 2,000 recordings of these UFOs crashing into the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, they melt snow. They depress the ground by as much as 8 or 9 inches. They damage the vegetation. But when you go to the site, there's no artifacts. Now, when an aircraft crashes into the Earth, there's debris. When a UFO crashes into the Earth, there's no debris. On the other hand, you can't deny the physical effects. And that's why we conclude that the UFO, the residual UFO phenomena, is real but not physical. And this explains why so many of my scientist peers simply wave away the UFO phenomena and say it's impossible. But it's because their worldview perspective does not allow for the existence of non-physical reality. My worldview perspective does, and I would argue that such things as the space-time theorems of general relativity scientifically prove that non-physical reality must indeed exist. That being the case, then we have a hard scientific evidence that there is something out there that's impacting human activity that's not physical in nature, but nevertheless is real. And, you know, if you read the Bible, it tells us that angels are of two types. There are the righteous angels, and there are the evil angels. And therefore, we need to examine the UFO phenomena to see which of those two possibilities it fits. And, you know, I had one of my co-authors was a cult expert, Ken Samples. And what he points out is that, without exception, people who have close encounters, and especially repeated close encounters with these residual UFOs, it's always malicious. It's not benign. The best you're going to come away with is recurring terrifying nightmares. The worst is actually physical death. There are actually cases where people have suffered a serious injury and even death as a result of these exposures.
And there is nothing people can do to stop this intervention, is there?
I think there is. I mean, we refer to our interpretation on residual UFOs as a testable hypothesis. Because again, from a Christian perspective, this can't happen to you unless you invite this angelic invasion. And if you take away the invitation, that removes any possibility that you could experience these residual UFO phenomena. And so the test is this, remove the invitation cards and see if that works. If it works, that proves our hypothesis. If it doesn't work, that disproves our hypothesis.
That's fascinating. Do you believe that this angelic intervention then, why is it broken down between good and evil? Is that normal?
Well, I think there's plenty of evidence that, you know, with respect to the human species, there's evil that can't be explained by simply natural process. Darwinian evolution, for example, or survival of the fittest, will not explain the evil behavior of human beings. Now, it may explain why animals eat one another, but it's not going to explain an Adolf Hitler or a Joseph Stalin. And you look at those individuals, and what you recognize is they were evil to a point that was against their own purpose, against their own self-interest. And therefore, I would argue there's something supernatural about the evil that certain individuals have manifested. They had help.
That is amazing, Hugh, primarily because what we're taught in our early days of religion has some similarities to it, but we're not taught this, because to me, this intervention, the evil part of it is especially, is very dangerous. I had Dr. David Jacobs on the show last week, and you know, he believes that this alien abduction phenomena is dangerous, is being done, is not being done for the good of mankind. He doesn't take the angelic step. But nonetheless, the similarities between what he says and what you say are very close.
They are. I'm quite skeptical of the idea that people are being physically abducted aboard spacecraft, you know, beings from outer space coming and doing that.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think these you know, fallen angels or evil angels fully have the capability of putting people through hallucinatory experiences, even a group of people through the identical hallucinatory experience, and make them think that they actually had this experience. You know, the Bible tells us these fallen angels are out to deceive us and are out to do us harm, but that they're very powerful and they can do things that we would otherwise think to be impossible.
Well, why is there the evil end of what we've just talked about? What's the mission here? What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, I mean, the Bible tells us that there's this battle between good and evil going on, and it's a cosmic battle. I mean, we're told that we don't wrestle against the blood and flesh. We wrestle against these spiritual beings that are at war with one another. So in that sense, there's a war in heaven, and we're very much involved in that. And you say, what's really going on? Well, I mean, I speculate that what's really taking place is that these fallen angels know that they have been condemned by the creator of the universe, but they're trying to figure out a way to get as many human beings into the same state of condemnation that they're in, with a mistaken idea that if they get enough human beings to go along with them, that maybe God will let everybody off. And so their mission is to get as many of us human beings as possible into the same evil state that they're in. And then we're told in the Bible that we're to resist that, that God, in fact, is on a mission to conquer evil once and for all. And once evil is conquered, we're told that this universe will be replaced by a brand new one, one that's far better than the universe in which we live. Or to put it another way, God created this universe, and it's created in a perfect state to bring about a rapid, efficient conquest of evil. But that God's ultimate plan is to bring those human beings that so choose into a new creation where evil will never exist.
Why the separation between the physical realm and the spiritual realm?
Well, the physical realm is a place where God has set up the ideal physics in which human beings can discover God, discover his purpose, their own purpose, and also to engineer this rapid, efficient conquest of evil. We're also told that the universe is created, told in the Bible, that the universe is created in such a way not only to instruct human beings about God and his future plan, but also the angels themselves. In fact, we're told that the angels are intently observing the universe and human beings in particular, trying to figure out the wisdom behind God's plan.
I wonder if we were formed to combat evil because maybe we're the only beings that can.
Well, we're part of God's plan to bring about that conquest. I mean, you know, he's the primary agent. I firmly believe he created us human beings for an eternal purpose, not only to experience the grace of God, because the angels watch God's undeserved favor being poured out upon humanity. They don't experience that themselves, but they're able to observe us human beings experiencing it. And because of that experience, we're receiving a training that will enable us to fulfill a much higher purpose than the angels will fulfill in the creation that will follow this creation.
Fascinating. Of the two areas that you have expertise in, the physical realm, and you're very good at the spiritual realm. Is there one that's a little more important than the other, or are they equal?
Well, the Bible tells us that God has given us two books. He gave us the 66 books that are recorded in the Bible, but he also gave us the book of nature. Both are revelations from the Creator, and we're exhorted to study both, and to study both in order that we can learn about the glory and the righteousness of the Creator, and also to understand our purpose, not only in this universe, but in the creation that will follow.
You're one of the few scientists, Hugh, that believes, I think, in this theory, because they're not as open-minded as you.
Actually, there are many scientists that are like myself.
Really?
Yeah.
Where are they?
Well, one of the things we're trying to do through Reasons to Believe, we're forming chapters in cities all over the United States, and for that matter, the world, where we're collecting together like-minded scientists and lay people. And for one reason, so that people would realize it's not just a few freaks like myself and, say, Fuzz Rana that believe this way, but there's actually a significant fraction of research scientists who hold my worldview and are willing to work with us in a joint effort to try to get this kind of exhortation to study both books out there, integrate it, and discover, you know, the purpose that God has you for living here on Earth. I firmly believe that God has got a different purpose for every human being, and that we're here to find that purpose and to fulfill it.
Well, you may be onto something here, Hugh. I'll tell you. You've done some work on, because it is Christmas, the Christmas star. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, we have an article up on our reasons.org website that gives you all the details. But very briefly, I believe that the theory that the Christmas star is a conjunction of planets or a supernova, that must be wrong. I discount the supernova explanation because it's just too spectacular. I mean, the Chinese don't record the Christmas star, the Indians don't, the Persians don't, the Romans and Greeks don't. So I don't think it could be something that spectacular. And also the text tells us, Matthew chapter 2 in the Bible, that this star reappeared. It didn't just show up once. It became bright, it disappeared, and about a year and a half later, it became bright again and then quickly disappeared. And the conjunction of planets, we can, you know, reconstruct that through our ephemeris, and there's no spectacular conjunction of planets at the time that Jesus could have been born. The best you can find is a couple of planets that are maybe 1.5 moon diameters apart. But the problem is that happens about once a year. It's simply too common. And therefore, I believe that the Christmas star most likely is what we call a recurring nova, not a supernova, but a star that would explode to such a degree it would go from invisibility to, say, a star about as bright as the North Star, as bright as Polaris, and then disappear. And because of the nature of the nova, it actually has the possibility of exploding 1 or 2 years later. And therefore, that could really explain all the events we see recorded in the Bible, where the wise men see the star in the east, they mount an expedition, and by the way, the star did not point them to the location. It simply indicated the time. And they went to Jerusalem, it tells us in the Bible, to inquire of the scribes and Pharisees as to the location. And they said, it's Micah that tells us that the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. So then they go down to Bethlehem, and as they approach Bethlehem, the star reappears. Now, I say about a year and a half because we're told in the biblical text that King Herod closely questioned the Magi to find out the time in which the star appeared to them in the east. And based on that knowledge, he killed every firstborn boy 2 years of age and younger in the village of Bethlehem. And so that's why I think we're looking at about a year and a half between the two appearances.
Weren't those amazing times on this planet?
They really were.
My gosh. And for people to interpret celestial events and do what he did. I mean, what would cause him to do that?
Well, I think the Magi had help. I mean, the scribes and Pharisees in Jerusalem were aware of the minor prophets. However, the Magi in the East would have been aware of one book of the Bible, namely the book of Daniel, because Daniel was one of the wise men. He was the chief of the wise men for both the Babylonian and the Persian Empire. So I don't think his text would have been ignored by the wise men at the time of Jesus. And the interesting thing there is Daniel is the only Old Testament prophet that predicts the timing of the coming of the Messiah. So based on Daniel, they would have known the time. And based on that knowledge of the time, they would have been looking in the heavens for a more specific sign. But it was the scribes and Pharisees in Jerusalem that knew the location.
Fascinating. Well, we're going to take phone calls next hour, Hugh, with people. We can talk to them about what we've been talking about in addition to the space issues at hand. And this spacecraft launch that's going to occur Wednesday that the French are behind in a multinational force, they're going to look for Earth-like planets. If you find an Earth-like planet, in your opinion, what are the odds that there's going to be life on it?
Well, you need a lot more than just an Earth-type planet to find life on it. Hundreds of other characteristics must be fulfilled.
All right, stay with
skeptical.
Us. Phone lines are open. We'll be back.